within the chart there.
Kali.
Ya blue da blue. Blue da blue. Blue blue da blue. Hello. Sorry. Mo 26 on da blue so blue da blue. Ko ba un. Jano byo la 26 on da blue blue da blue hello lu. Ta nai ba pyet da. Ko
duwa hello. Ta nai pyet da shee duwa ro de do ma ta hu ko ma le.
ကျွန်တော်တော့ level 4ရဲ့
level
4အဲ့ဒါ
level 4ရေ
ကျွန်တော်တက်တာ5ဟုတ်ပဲတက်ဘူ
း We have just released a new report that sets out the continuing spiral of violence in Myanmar since the 1st of February coup of last year and the military is continuing to engage in systematic and widespread human rights violations and abuses some of which may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity
The area at the epicenter of the disaster that struck 2 weeks ago is desperately short of food, water and medical aid. Instead, their government sent them bombs.
At Insight Myanmar, we strive to highlight the resilience and struggles of the Burmese people as they navigate extraordinary challenges in their fight for justice and freedom.Through their stories, we witness acts of courage and determination, but also the complexities, hardships, and uncertainties that come with such a monumental struggle. Our role is not to romanticize or idealize, but to amplify authentic voices, foster understanding, and create space for deeper reflection. The people of Myanmar lead their own fight for dignity and human rights, and we stand alongside them in solidarity, sharing their experiences and perspectives with the world.
Welcome back. And ladies and gentlemen, I can say that we are very privileged on Inside Myanmar to have so many experts and so many witnesses and so many activists and so many artists join us and give their insights and give their experiences and opinions. But it is a rare privilege to be given such an insight into a topic of such significance to all of us. I am joined today by a former serving member of the Myanmar military who has defected post-coup in protest and in disgust. And we are going to delve into the realities of life in the military, the leadership, the motivations, the state of the morale and the state of the capabilities on the ground. But before we get into that, thank you very much for joining us and thank you very much for sharing your knowledge and your insights with us. I know that this is going to be probably one of the most important episodes that we do, and I really appreciate it, but I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself directly for our audience.
Okay, thank you for inviting me in your podcast. Yeah, I'm very excited to be here, like to share what's happening in Myanmar, what's happening in military with to the world along with you. So yeah, let me introduce myself. My name is Cho Cho, and I am a former military doctor, in exactly a military pediatrician before the coup. And since coup happened in like February 2021, yes, and 1 month after the coup, I left the military in protest of the coup, and I cannot accept that military dictatorship, like taking power over our people's elected democratic government.
Absolutely. And I think we can all I think we can all sympathize with that. We can all respect that. But before we get to that, I want to sort of cover a little bit of the background here. So what made you join the military? I know going to medical school must be expensive. Were you motivated by the hope of getting a government-subsidized education, or were you passionately committed to the military's cause?
Yes, and I've tried the military in around 2006 after, you know, I graduated from the high school. So back then, I guess military propaganda is a little bit strong over the country and over the young people like us. So I partly believe that I can do good for the people while serving for the military. And I instantly know I was wrong since in first or second year of the military medical academy. But that's another story. And you're right. Honestly, I needed some, you know, some tuition expense to go into the civilian medical university. That is one of the reasons why I joined this Defense Services Medical Academy.
Because I've had students in the past who were military doctors or who were military pilots, military engineers, and this was one of the very common themes, was saying that they knew that they could not afford the education that they needed to do what they were passionate about. And so they would join the military, they would do the military-funded education, they would serve for a certain number of years, and then they would try to leave and join the civilian sector. Were you hoping to just make it out into a civilian pediatric hospital?
Yes. Actually, when I say I instantly regretted joining the military in a couple of years in this military medical school, but I still have some, you know, some love for the people in the military or in the army, especially the low rank individual who were suffering so much oppression, so much violating human rights and everything. I wanted to help them. So when our government changed into the democratically elected government in supposedly 2010, but actually in 2015 after Anneli got the office. So I was hoping that our military could change along with the country as people wanted. So I want the military to be a better institution that really doing good for people. And then I wanted our military to be, you know, clear of the politics, and I can serve and say proudly that I am a military pediatrician. I am helping the civilian people, and I am helping the family of the soldier. So I kind of like that. So I didn't expect too much on like moving into the civilian status or anything, because I wanted the military to be improved and to be clean of corruption. But it is far-fetched now. I can see that. So yes, I had hope before the coup that our military would change along with the government. But as soon as they started the coup, I know all of my dreams and all of my hopes are being thrown into the ditches. So yeah, that's what happened.
And I think this is a common theme, not just in Myanmar, but in many countries of people who listen to military propaganda, they grow up on military propaganda, and then they join the military and they look around and they realize that the military as an institution is not what they thought that it would be. And I'm wondering what was the moment for you where you realized, okay, this military is not what I thought, this is not what they said that I would be doing, or this is not honorable, this is not decent. What was the thing, if there was one thing that happened that made you change your mind?
Yes. So back then, although we didn't have much insights and about a real information, what happened in the last uprising, like, you know, 4 days uprising in, and we call 4H revolution or, you know, AAAA uprising. But I didn't get much information about that and how military would operate like viciously and brutally when that kind of uprising occurred. But in the 2007, there's a revolution, uprising called a Saffron Revolution, where monks and civilians are protesting against the military government. But then I'm already a medical student in the Army Medical University. So I saw and I was in Yangon, so I saw firsthand how they can be brutal against the monks and, you know, against the civilians and everything. So I instantly like realized that that is not how a government or that is not a institution that is supposed to be protect monks and civilians should do. So now I got some idea of it. But and after a long years in the medical university, when they are teaching some kind of military tactic and their military, you know, doctrines and their ideology, and I as the more I learn about their ways or things and the ways that they're doing, the more I learn that they are in the wrong places in all along the history. Like for example, I remember one thing specifically in the second year of my medical university, an officer like came to us to talk about how we should, you know, interact with the ethnic and forces in the, you know, in some conflicted area. But he suggested us that if you want to avoid court martial after you wrongfully killing a civilian, that is an easy matter. You just bring some kind of batteries in your pocket if you have to go to the front lines or if you have to go to the conflicted zones. If you kill someone and found out that he or she is a civilian, you just slip some of your battery into the victim's pocket, and you can see that he is a rebel that is trying to plant a landmine to the troops, and then you can just get off the hook from the murder charges and killing civilian charges. So they are teaching that kind of thing, like smart things or right thing to do, and I feel really disgusted. That's just one small example. Like their ideologies are so wrong against their religions, you know, against the ethnic groups and everything. And even after, I remember, like after I graduated, I have to attend an officer training SISMA in the Korean region, and I asked the, I asked the authority, but in the training school, and they asked whether we have in danger that the ethnic group could attack or something. They probably said that they don't dare to attack us because they have all the artillery aiming to all over their villages. So it doesn't matter who attack X or when the ethnic organization attack X, they will just blindly shoot their artillery around their villages, and like there will be a lot of casualty among their ethnicity, among their civilians. So they won't be there to attack X. They are like saying probably it's like a, you know, buffer, I don't know, security measures or something. I feel really disgusted about it. If we are afraid of being attacked by the ethnic group, we have to keep our security tight and we have to be ready to fight against the ethnic group. Why do we have to like aim our artillery against the peacefully living civilian villagers? Yeah, you know, I will just drop these two examples and you can guess how I am disgusted in the military by their doctrines and ideologies and matters.
And so this is interesting because there are many militaries around the world that have engaged in similar things. I know, for example, in the Australian military special forces, they had a policy of using walkie-talkies. They would put walkie-talkies onto the dead bodies of civilians. Not a practice. They would put the walkie-talkies and they would use that to say, well, this person was an enemy. But to my knowledge, this was never taught. This was not an instruction that was given. But you're saying that the Myanmar military is directly instructing its soldiers in committing war crimes.
Yes. They it's supposed like they didn't need they. I mean, in their teaching, they didn't knew what is war crime, because in my CCL attending in the medical university, I had never heard about the talking about the war crimes, and you know they have never, I think most of the soldier might never heard of Geneva Convention, and it is too late, or and they are forced by someone. So I think yes, it's part of their, you know, ideology that these kind of things can be like, and it's not against the code of conduct or things like that. I think they think like that, and they want the soldier to think like that. For example, sometimes, like if they wrongfully like torture, interrogate a villager or something, they suggested that they should kill that villager and like rid of the body so that the civilians sometimes, the villager won't know who did it or, you know, who is the culprit or which unit did it, so that they will not be revenged in their approaching and in their patrolling situation. Like, yes, so you could say that all the teaching ideology could lead to violence and committing war crime. Yeah.
I mean, because this is deeply, deeply disturbing. Like, we expect a professional modern military to have classes, and this is something that most Western militaries would do. They would have classes to teach their soldiers and to teach their officers what is correct conduct, what is a legitimate target. There's what we call in English the rules of engagement. Who can be shot at? Under what circumstances can they be shot at? We have what's called the escalation of force. So a process where you have to identify yourself audio, you have to identify yourself visually, identify verbally, you fire not even a warning shot. First you have to fire something non-lethal, then you fire a warning shot, and then you can shoot someone. And there's a very complicated process to make sure that you did this correctly. So is it true to say that in the Myanmar military there is no education on rules of engagement, no education on correct conduct, no education on escalation of force? Is there any fear that if you shoot someone without proving that they were a threat, that you would be court-martialed?
Yes. So there is some, you know, standard procedure for court-martial, for wrongfully killing the civilians and things like that. But it only happened once in a while, when only the, you know, press or the large number of civilians found out what they did. So in example, I think around in 2007, a military battalion have killed about 5 civilians. And when this thing and came into light, some of the commanders and battalion commander and division commander were court-martialed. And I think at least about 5 or 6 people are put into prison. But only one of them had to stay in the prison because he refused to kill, like, 3 of the civilians, and he talked about this as a witness in the court martial. So he had to stay in the prison for about like 20 years. And the other people that are really responsible for that murders were like get out of prison in a very short time. The punishment is only on the paper. So that kind of thing happened in the military.
Okay. I mean, that's terrifying. And the other side of it, and this is something that's also quite important, I think, is the treatment of the soldiers. So I've heard from Western, you know, military representatives and people like that who have seen the conditions in the Myanmar military, and I've heard it said that within the Myanmar military, the treatment of the soldiers, particularly enlisted soldiers who are not officers, is very poor. That physical punishment is very frequently used. The living conditions are not really suitable. The food is not really suitable. And that the entire culture of the military is designed to hurt and to psychologically break soldiers. Would you say that is correct?
Yes, that is a very correct insight, you know. And about the punishment, you're right. Mostly the disciplining in the military came from the officer to the non-warranted officer. Non-warranted soldiers were like, you know, they might be involved like punching, slapping, and kicking in the office, and sometimes like beating them with sticks and those kind of things. They think that's the right kind of discipline to the soldiers. And that is one thing I think that they are doing wrong. But the most importantly, like systematically, I think in most of the, you know, standard army, the really standard army in other country, like most of the soldiers might heard of or know of about the PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. But if you try that word in the Myanmar military population, I think not more than 10 or 20% of the soldier might heard of it. Far from like really being treated or really being diagnosed. Yeah, you can just, if you can ask the military headquarters or Medicare, I don't know, like Medicare headquarters, like how many of recorded PTSD kit in your forces. We would say like it would be like very few or maybe none, because you know the military usually do psych evaluation, but it is not proper. They don't even care about the results because they need the manpower. And so in military, in over 10 years that I have served in the military, I have seen some people with like poor mental condition, like poor mental health, and some might be suffered from PTSD. And then at least one third of the forces are alcoholic and drug addicts. And actually, we are supposed to diagnose them. We are supposed to help them. If we cannot help them, we have to be dismissed them. And like we have to help them as veteran and in the other area. But no, there has been never a proper treatment for the PTSD and other mental health. There has not been a proper diagnosis, screening procedures for the alcoholic and drug addicts. So if, independent team, a medical team has to screen all the soldiers in the forces, I think at least, 30% or 40% of the infantry soldiers have to be dismissed because of mental instability and drug addiction and alcoholism. But still, they are using them as weapon. And maybe the top leaders might know about these kind of mental issue, and maybe they might not smart enough to aware of this. So, usually, if a troop came back from the front lines or from the battle, we have to do a proper psych evaluation and treat them as necessary. But no, they have to go to the like physical fitness trainings, or sometimes division leaders where it came to say you did a very good job and now rest a while and then you have to fight again. That they just say those kind of things. They don't care about their mentalities and everything. That's why I think half of the brutality and war crimes and atrocity occur in the front line and among the civilians, because I mean a portion of them are already they might be like psychopath, they might be with like psychological trauma, and like bluntly, I had to say some of them are lunatics already. And there is like drug addiction and alcoholism that they are like using the soldier that are not supposed to be in the military, like with the power to hold a gun. Like some of these people might not be even fit to live in the civilian society. They should be in the mental institutes, if I have to say. So yeah, that's the really, these soldiers are also victims from the mental abuse and the oppression from the top army, and also they are also the perpetrator, like killings and oppressing the civilians. So yeah, and then they have to get the right punishment, that those soldiers in the base. But that I in my opinion, that leaders should take the twice and double punishment as how much these soldiers committed war crimes. That's my opinion.
And I want to look at some of these things, because you talk first and foremost about drug and alcohol. And I wonder what your estimate would be. Like, what, first of all, what are the drugs that they are taking? Secondly, what would be the percentage of people taking these drugs? And thirdly, how are they getting them? Because you would presume soldiers will always find a way to make alcohol. Soldiers will always find a way to get drugs. We know that. But if it's a large problem, that indicates that there is a complete breakdown of control by the officers over their soldiers, that someone is moving drugs into a camp and the officers either do not know or do not care. So how bad is the drug alcohol situation?
Yeah, that's a big statistic. So I cannot say that with my experience, I cannot say that I know the exact percentage of the military. Like, but I can estimate, and from my experience, because I have some colleagues that are working with the infantry forces, and mainly in the infantry forces rather than some technician like engineer and medical forces. So in the infantry forces, when they are in the front line or when they are in the conflicted area, I think 80% of them has I think they want to use, they have to use something like for their entertainment, like alcohol and cigarettes. Cigarette is the mildest form, alcohol and other form of drugs. I must say the most they use is the Yaba, you know, the blue wine. And then there might be some heroin along the way, and some might use weed. But so I'm not sure about the region that I have never been to, but I have been to like Korean region, and I have to have some of the defector and some of the war prisoner in the, you know, Korean region. I have to interview with them, like, have you ever used Yabas or things like that? And then they say, yes, they can easily buy it from the Boracay folks from the Korean region. Yeah, there is a Boracay folk in the Korean region, like you must have of it. Yeah, they just easily sold the soldiers, and they can just buy from these kind of forces, you know, that kind of forces that are aligned with the military. There were some kind of, you know, Boracay forces that were aligned with the military in all over the region.
I mean, but that's terrifying. I understand the boredom, and this is something that you hear from soldiers across all cultures, huge periods of boredom, sitting around waiting for something to happen, and then the anxiety of waiting for something to happen that could kill you. It's very difficult, and you can understand why people would turn to something like drugs and alcohol and cigarettes and so on. But you said 80%.
Yes.
80. That's enormous.
Yes. It's really terrifying. And I'm even amazed that my colleagues, even one after they came back from the, you know, front lines along with the infantry forces, they were also amazed. Like, for instance, some of the unit, when they have to patrol, I mean, this before the coup and before the war, even that time when they keep patrolling in a completed area, at least one or two of the infantry soldiers dying of like drug overdose, and sometimes like because of the alcoholism, or sometimes because of the severe hypertension and disease like diabetes, because they are not getting proper treatment, and they are using people that should already be given like Medicaid pension since long ago. So yeah, that kind of thing happened.
But the conclusion we could come to here is that a very, very large component of the frontline military, if we ignore the psychopathy and the fact that they should not be serving in a military for moral, ethical reasons, professional reasons, looking at those who are suffering from medical conditions, who are unwell, who are too drunk, who are too stoned to be able to operate, you seem to be saying that probably the majority of soldiers on the front line are not physically, mentally fit to be soldiers. They are not capable of doing the job.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. If I have the capability to screen all the diseases and drug addiction and psychological stability, I think I might have to expel, like, I don't know, at least 50 or 60% of the infantry soldiers from the military, and they will need like help and 3 months and everything.
It makes you wonder how the military was ever able to operate against the ethnic armed organizations, and now that they're fighting against the PDF as well. I'm wondering, do you believe that there is any chance that now that the fighting has become more intense, that the Tamado is losing its position, that officers have become more strict, that soldiers are taking it more seriously and have stopped using their drugs and stopped drinking alcohol? Or would they be just as drunk and just as drug addicted as they were before?
And actually, it would be worse, because, you know, most of the officer, they can properly control these kind of soldier, and they cannot properly discipline the soldier, because so they have to rely on such thing like alcohol or drugs. Like, if you know, for example, if a commander or officer could provide those kind of recreation in the front line, he might be considered as a good leader by their fellow soldiers. So when the kind of fighting was more intense, and when they are being pressured from a lot of direction, I think they will be more reliant and they will be using more of the drugs and alcohol. And that's really what's really happening in the conflicted area. If you research some footage and some of the records from the war prisoner and from the result of the clashes between resistance forces and military, you will see a lot of the, you know, drug addicts and a lot of the very aged people who are already near their pension age and things like that with their medical condition. So you will find a lot of them in the war prisoner list and fallen soldier list.
Wow. So I mean, this is incredible. And another thing that I want to focus on here, like now that we're seeing this dependence on alcohol and drugs, and we're seeing this lack of regard for the rights of civilians and all this, the two big things that come up with regards to the military's interaction with civilians and civilian populations. The first is what we might broadly consider looting, so an extortion, so taking goods from civilians, taking alcohol from alcohol shops without paying, stealing money from shops, and the second is the sexual assault. And I want to understand the mentality and the culture, because from the outside, reporting on the cases where victims have been attacked by the military, it feels like the infantry, especially the light infantry divisions, seem to feel that they are allowed to take anything from any civilian, especially ethnic minorities, and also feel like they are allowed to sexually assault any women that they want. Can you shed some light on the culture within the military regarding these things?
Yes, it's just, you know, like it's just a general principle, because, you know, when we want a population to follow the rules, and we have two ways, like teaching them about the morals so that they understand what is right and what is wrong. The other thing is like setting up rules and enforce them so looking at the Myanmar military, like they have no teaching, no proper, you know, training and discipline about what is right and wrong, what is code of conduct, and what is the Geneva Convention and things like that. So they don't have any morality at all already. But then again, they have like a lot of code of conduct and rules on the people. What is the use of the law when there is no punishment, repercussion, or enforcement of the law? Mm-hmm. That's what's happening in Myanmar military. If a soldier can successfully, you know, can operate a mission successfully, the military leader won't care how they did it or which kind of things they looted or which kind of sexual assaults they committed on the civilians or war prisoners. That's the real problem there, because the leaders, commander, only want the result, and they might think that the end justifies the means. And then there's a very wrong role models, you know, in the generation or the military. Since they have no proper training about the code of conduct, they have to realize what to do in the front line from their seniors. And all the senior soldiers were, you know, they are bragging and they're boasting about how they shoot the protesting civilian crowd and how they like crack down violently, and they boasted it as like a successful mission. And then they also brag about how much they gained from the front line, like how they found the gold and, you know, jewelry in the empty houses and things like that. So when the old generation of the soldier are bragging about these kind of war crime as an accomplishment, so it is not a strange thing that these now current generation is committing all the war crime they can, because this is their teaching, like since they joined the military.
And so, I mean, as horrifying as all this is, I also want to get a bit of an understanding of the condition of the military as a fighting force, because what we have heard prior to the coup, what we were hearing about the Myanmar military is that the military was pushing very aggressively for a military size of 500,000. That is what they were trying to achieve. And we were hearing the military say numbers like they've achieved, you know, 350,000, 400,000. in the military. And what we have seen since the coup is that in a lot of cases, a battalion that should have 500 people maybe only has 120 people. Some battalions don't actually exist. They only exist on paper in a document, but there's no actual human being inside that battalion, even though it has a name, it has a location, it has a flag. And what we've also seen from the ethnic armed organizations is that many of the people in the Tamador have very old weapons, very old equipment, things that are not working, and they're running out of ammunition and they're running out of everything. So I'm wondering, from your experience before the coup, what was the state of the military? How large was the fighting force really? What was the quality of the equipment that people had? What was the quality of the supplies that people had available to them? What was the actual fighting ability of the Tamador?
Yeah, actually, that 500,000 things is like a joke to the people who knows really what's happening inside the military. Like, half of the military know it's not the real numbers, because, you know, there's a lot of, like, deserter since before the coup, like, because of the hardship and oppression. Like, a lot of people, a lot of individuals are, like, deserting the military. But the commander cannot report the exact number of desertation, because it might affect their promotion, and it might affect their impression over the commander. So yes, they usually lying about this kind of thing. So they have two benefits. One thing, they can maintain their good name, so that they has not many desert. And then again, they can, you know, take out the supplies and salary from those deserted soldiers, and they can use this for personal gain. So they are having like double benefits from those kind of situation. So since then, it's like over a decade ago, the military, the top commander on paper military number is really high, like 300,000, 400,000 and everything. But I think in reality, it would be only like, I don't know, two-thirds of the real the numbers. And now I think it would be like half of the number. So now if they say they have like 400,000, I could say like they have 200,000. The fighting would be less than 80,000, since they have a lot of technicians, and they have other, you know, female soldiers and all age, like near pension age soldiers. So yes, I think so. Everyone from the military knows that the real fighting force is like not even the half of the number that they are saying in public and they are saying in record. And also the military, top military commander also tend to be like, you know, asking the budget from the, when they are asking the budget from the government, especially democratic government, they have to put a lot of extra numbers and a lot of extra costs, so that they can be, you know, corrupted and take the money for themselves. That's one thing about the, you know, real fighting forces or the military. It has been like depleting since many years ago with those kind of corruption. And then when we talk about their equipment, you know, I will drop you some example of how the top leader Mian Lai has corruption. You know, when every time he came to visit a hospital or a battalion, like we used to call him behind his back that he is a gunfighter, because when he came to a battalion or a hospital, he point finger as like repair this building and buying those things and build those things and everything. And then the commander of the troops have to take note down those kind of things, but they cannot find a proper tenders or, you know, proper organization that can really do the projects for them. They have to go to his relative, his family, you know, some maybe his son or his nephew's company to bring up these projects. So, and then they will take as much as money they want from their military budget, and they will build and buy crappy things, and there is no one who's there to say against them, and there is no quality control against them. I mean, who would dare to like say the nephews or sons or the top leader that you are bidding is like unqualified or something. So yes, they get away with everything, and they are getting, his family is getting much profit by, you know, abusing the power and resources of the country. And for instance, we can just say like a bidding like Bitpaint, their company, like 1 or 2 years ago, has already crashed and all the painting has already fainted. Those kind of low quality things happen all over the country. So the soldiers are getting like crappy equipment, crappy supplies, and the hospital are getting like crappy drugs and insufficient supply and things like that. When I work in a hospital, I remember that I have to spend from my own money to buy some medicine for our patients, since the hospital cannot supply some of the medicine, and you know, so I think every military doctor has at least spent their own money to treat their patient. Yeah, that's like a, you know, regular things for the doctors, and who cannot stand and look the patient suffer. So that kind of things happening in the military.
I mean, it reminds me so much of stories that I hear from Hungary and similar countries like that, up to and including hospitals having to use their own money, like doctors having to use their own money to buy patients. So, in fact, just as a side note, I've even seen a sign in Hungary from a hospital saying, "We cannot guarantee enough bandages for all of our patients. Please bring them from home." Terrible, terrible conditions. But I just wanted to go back to the anecdote, because I think it's such an important example that you've outlined. So you're saying that Minaholang will come to a base and he will make a big show of pointing at everything and saying that this has to be changed, this has to be fixed, this has to be improved, this has to be this has to be that. And he looks like a leader and he looks like he wants to improve the state of the military. But then in reality, this just means that the local officer has to allow Minaholang's family and his friends to take a contract to do work and charge many, 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 many times more money for it than they need to. So it's a scam.
Yes, that's what happening with his family. So, I mean, I don't know. There are some lobbyists and some people that really believe that Minaholang is like that much worthy and has so much money. And where did he get the money? Some people even can't think about it. They still think that Minaholang is a righteous man or something. You know, this is just incredibly stupid for, like, you know, some people with some common sense can just figure it out. You know, he's already multimillionaire, so where did the money come from? Yeah, that's simple. Yes, he's not a generational wealth. Yeah.
And so let's talk about that money then, because this is the other thing that we wonder about, is can you make this kind of money in the military? What can you earn? So what can you tell us about the salaries in the military?
Yes, salary from the military. So, I mean, so is for us like captains, like we used to earn up in the highest, or like, I don't know, 3.7 lakhs in Myanmar cash. But back then, even with the currency exchange, it was only worth like, I don't know, $200 or something. Yeah. So for the police forces and for the non-resident soldiers, like, it would be a lot less. There would be like 2 lakhs or things like that. So it would only allow them to be like survive month after month. But there is no future for them. Yeah. They cannot build any kind of future or worth for their children or for themselves.
And so let's clarify that. So you're saying 3.7 lakh, so that's 370,000 Myanmar chat per month, is what you were paid as a captain. Were you paid extra because you were a doctor, or are you paid the same as every other captain?
No.
Okay, so all captains are the same salary.
Yeah, all captains are exactly like the same, but they have to give some extra money for the specialist and some kind of technician. So maybe we will get extra 1 or 2,000 chat in the salary. Yes, more than other like common captains.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, but you know, 2,000 chat is nothing. Yeah, it's just a 1 day expense for snacks and things like that. Yeah. So
okay. So at an exchange of about 1,000, like at the time before the coup, at an exchange of about 1,500 chat to the US dollar, you're looking at about $250 a month, which is not terrible. But can you tell us how much a soldier would be making who is not an officer?
A soldier would be like around 2 lakhs, so I think it would be like around over $100 for the month. So yeah, they can barely live and survive. Like, I don't think they can afford a good education for their children. And maybe if their family member have some kind of health emergency, they can only rely on the military hospital. Apart from that, they don't have any extra spend for their recreations and for their, I don't know, vacation or things like that. They are barely surviving, making from day to day.
Okay, so that's very interesting. But then the other thing that we hear about a lot are these shares from MEC, MEHL, which is a huge conglomerate of many industries across Myanmar that is owned by the military, and soldiers buy shares. So were you, as a captain, were you required to purchase shares?
Yes, actually, everyone was forced to to buy shares from their organization. Yeah, no matter how much his salary is, at least a small portion of the money have to be spent monthly for those companies. So, in my case, like, I have to spend more than 10 lakhs and 50 lakhs buying shares. Yeah. And then the other thing is that they are not only forcing the soldiers to buy the shares, they are also forcing to pay for the life insurance company, that is bid by them, also bid by the Myanmar families. And that life insurance company is exploiting in every way they can against the soldiers. In the battlefield, a soldier might be missed or disappear, and we could assume he's dead or something if he doesn't turn up for money must. But as long as the body is not came back from the front lines, or there is no death confirmation, all of the health insurance money will be hurt. And then there's a lot of other ridiculous rules, like a soldier is not supposed to ride a motorcycle, and the officer below the major position is not permitted to ride even motor car. So sometimes the military personnel have get into accident with the cycles or with the cars, and also they are not getting any healthcare insurance money because they have break the military rules. But this is ridiculous, because this is a civilian life insurance company like collaborating with the military, and they shouldn't be doing full enforcing the military rule for their life insurance money, but they still do it. So they always find a way to refuse the life insurance compensation when a soldier is fallen or dead from any kind of thing. They are always finding a loophole to exploit that kind of money. Yeah, that's also happening all over in the military.
And are you required to use a military bank?
Actually, yes. Because we have to take, we have to get our salary check from a specific military bank called Myawri Bank. So yes, they are using that banking to circulate our money, and they are also getting profit from that too. Yes.
Okay, very interesting. And you said, and I wanted to go back to the shares that you were buying from MEC, MEHL. Were you saying that you had to buy them every month?
Yes, actually, they just set certain amount of shares. If a captain or a soldier cannot afford to buy in one instant, they have to pay monthly to pay their required share to buy from their company. So if I have the money, I can just pay instant that I will buy for an instant, like 10 lakhs worth of shares, and then I will be left alone, like the commander will be nagging me for at least 1 year, that kind of thing.
Wow. Is that, but 10 lakhs is a lot, because 10 lakhs is 1 million chat.
Yes, which is like 1 million.
It's a lot of money.
Yes, which is worth my 3 months salary. But at least I can find some money from working extra hour in the clinic in my free times or something. But stay, they also forbid the military personnel to be work in the private clinic even for a part time, because we have to do it anyway, because the salary they are giving is not enough for us to be to build our for the study and next degree and for even for the family. So what So that's the, I don't know, that's the daughter's privilege, so that we can, at least we can earn honest money by defying some of the orders. But what about the other technician and other soldier that are not able to find the extra income like X? So they would turn to the extortion, corruption and everything. So yeah, that kind of thing happens.
Yeah. Because this is the big question, like, do the soldiers generally feel that they need extra money, that the salaries are not very good? 2 lakh is not, if you have a family, 2 lakh is not enough. But of course, in the military, you have military housing, you have the military hospital, you have military schools. So you expect that your expenses will not be so high. So do the soldiers generally feel that they do not have enough money to take care of their families and that they need to find other sources of money, even if it is illegal?
Yes. You know, some of the soldiers who are singles might be sometimes content with the money that they are given. But for a family, for example, if a family has like 2 children, yeah, so that would be the problem with the money. So most of the, you know, families, some people might have to support their, you know, their dad and mom, like it's like our Asian culture, like we have to look after our old parents. So yeah, so most of the people will always be thinking about like they should get more and their salary is not enough for them. Mm-hmm. For instance, for if you have 2 children, what is their salary? What do about their clothing? But they might be get into the military schools for free, but they will still need books and they will still need other expenses for their family, like to live like in a decent life. So yeah, at least majority of the soldier might feel that their salary not enough and they will always be finding some extra cash. And that lead to that kind of extortion and that kind of looting in the front line. Yeah. That is one of the factors.
And so this brings us to the very important turning point. So what you're saying to me here over the last, you know, 3/4 of an hour is that the condition of the military before the coup was very bad. The soldiers were being exploited and extorted by their leadership. They are not being paid sufficient money to take care of their families. They are not being given sufficient training, sufficient equipment. They are dependent on drugs and alcohol. They are being abused. They are being beaten. Life in the military is bad. And yet, when the coup happened, the majority of the military chose not to defect. And this is something I want to explore with you. But before we get into that, I want to ask about your defection, because you left the military very early after the coup. You knew that this was wrong, this is criminal, and you did not want to be a part of this. And I would like you to share that story for our audience to explain your thought process and your decision to leave.
Yes. So as soon as the coup happened, yeah, I have already made it my mind, because I can see there's 2 ways that could go. I know people, the whole country will protest, and there will be some, you know, foreign involvement to have to resolve the issues. So I just don't want to risk everything that I bid for. So I want to wait, and I was hoping that these protests would work against the military, and those, you know, foreign intervention would work against this coup, and so that the democratically elected government will came into power soon. That is my, you know, biggest hope back then. But I have already decided that if the military started cracking down the civilian violently, and if the international intervention will fail, that I must inevitably leave the military, because I cannot be part of the organization that is like beating, arresting, and killing the civilian unlawfully. That's my like decision back then. And then I wait for I just have to wait for it, you know, a couple of weeks. And then there's a young lady called Miato that can get killed. And then again, there's another young guys and another young girl in Mandalay get killed by military. Yes, I as soon as I saw the news, I think like three people has been killed by the military. That is more than enough. I cannot be part of this organization. Some of my colleagues might think and like tell themselves that they are not part of this this atrocity, but like they are just doing their work. They might be thinking like that, but I cannot. Because as long as I wear this uniform and I were in the list of their forces, I would be a part of this. So I cannot let my conscience just don't let me do it. So yes, I decided to leave as soon as a few people were killed by the military.
And so that's the other question, because it's obviously not easy to leave the military. I believe the penalty for desertion would be at a minimum a lengthy prison sentence, but possibly execution, especially now. So how did you manage to escape without being caught, without being punished?
Yes, actually, I could say, yeah, I have some colleagues in the military who is not agree with the will of the military, but have not enough courage to lead the military. But at least they support that I can leave, so that some of the people, like only a few person, that they can cover some of my shift, that the commander won't know I'm missing for at least a day. Then I can, and then I have to like contact a really trusted friend and a really trusted driver and tell them that my situation, and then I have to make arrangement to instantly, as soon as I leave the military bases, I have to get on that particular car, and then I have to leave to a safe place that my friends, the civilian friend, they are already protesting and they are already running around, and then they helped me to set up at a place and hide there. So yeah, that kind of thing I had heard from some military friends and from some civilian friends, and a very understanding driver, because he is also a supporter of democracy. So he also risks himself to drive me through many gates and many bases to accompany into a safe place.
Excellent. And so this is the other issue then, because you said that there are a lot of people in the military who are sympathetic, who agree with this. And we saw cartoons and memes as well, where you have, images of military leaving the camp through the front gate, saying, I'm tired of this, I'm leaving, and the guard at the gate is basically saying, okay, good luck, man, I don't care, because they know that this war is unethical, they know that it's wrong, and yet they do not leave, they do not defect. And the question is, how many soldiers do you think, especially in the infantry, how many soldiers do you think want to defect, are sympathetic to defecting, like do not want to fight, do not want the coup, are happy to go back to a civilian government, but are afraid to leave?
Yes. And when we talk about it, actually I see the military in like four particular groups in that kind of situation after the coup. The first group is like people like us, that they don't agree with the ways of the military, and they have enough courage and enough planning strategy to leave. So they left the military. That is the first group. The second group is that they knew that they are in the wrong position, wrong side of the history, but they don't have the courage to leave the military. Yeah, I might say like they are cowards, maybe because of the penalty or punishment, it would be like life imprisonment or the death penalty at least. So yes, that would be one thing. And then some of them might afraid how they would live in the community, how they keep running from the military, and how they can survive, and how they earn money to keep surviving. Those kind of things, they have to fear for those kind of things. And some people, they will also like fear of like how they will be treated by the pro-democratic forces and maybe resistant forces and armed forces. They are also afraid that they will not be welcomed, but it is not the case. They are very welcome, but they are not sure. So the second group is that they are afraid to leave, although they know they should have. And then there's a third group. Is that group, I can call them like greedy people, because they know they are in the wrong place, and then their organization, military, is doing wrong things, but they are getting profit And they have many interests in the military for Asian men, like specialist and doctor, like who are getting money, some position. And then another commander, another soldier who are getting money from the gays and from the briberies and extortion and things like that. So these greedy people won't leave, and they are being shot at. Their bases are being attacked. So they will keep staying in the military as long as they have profit and they are not getting any harmed, like they are not facing any instant danger. And then there's a last group, the fourth group. I can call this group a stupid group or ignorant group, because they think they are right. Like they are serving for the gantry. They are doing the right thing because they have a lot of propaganda about how they are protecting the major religion, the Buddhism, how they are protecting the government, the people, and how they are protecting their country being influenced by other country. Like, but they can even realize that they are already controlled by the Russian and Chinese, things like that. So there is a full group, and the last group is the ignorant and stupid group. So so when you ask about how many people want to leave the military, I think I did the first group and the second group. So at least half of the people might want to leave the military, because in the military, I think the portion of these four groups might be each 25%. So yes, so the other 50% won't leave the military as long as they can live and earn monies and get the opportunities. But as soon as the danger arrives, the third group, the greedy group, instantly surrenders or leave or run away or things like that. That's why there are being so many white flag and surrender in the front, because they are not fighting with their spirit. They are not fighting with their belief. They are just fighting for their own life and their own interests. So as soon as their life and their interests are being threatened, we just give up. So we will only have to deal with like 25% of the very stupid people in the military.
And so it's fascinating to me that the numbers that you're saying, that about half of the people in the military want to leave. It's almost difficult to believe that, because they still fight. This is the important point. Even those who want to leave are still participating, because if your commander says fire the artillery shell, you will fire the artillery shell. Even though you want to leave, you're still participating in the war effort. So are these people in some way helping? I know that there are many in the military who are referred to as watermelons. So green on the outside, red on the inside, sympathetic to the revolution. Are they working to undermine the military? Are they working to sabotage, to delay, to slow the military's efforts? Or are they fully engaged in the war, but waiting for an opportunity to escape?
Yes, actually, although I say that there are so many people who want to escape from the military, but about the watermelon, that I really have to respect them, because leaving the military is one thing. I mean, it can be dangerous and it can be very hard, but I don't think I will even have the courage to be a watermelon, because they are practically spying. They will be facing the harshest and most severe punishment if they are found out. So I think it is like a very, very little population that are that are working as a watermelon inside the military, like feeding intelligence and information for the pro-democratic forces and resistance forces. I really respect them, because I even don't have the courage to operate like them. But I think it is only a very few people. Like, it will be lucky if the number is over 100. Yes.
Wow. Okay, so that's very interesting. And then I want to talk about that third group. Like you say, about 25% of the military are these idiots who are genuinely ideologically aligned with the military leadership, or are just violent psychopaths and they enjoy killing people. It could be either. But them, we can't do much about them. But you also said this is 25% who are greedy. And they are afraid that they would not be accepted by society, and they think, well, maybe the military will win. And as you say, they can still get money. You mentioned the gates for the benefit of the audience who have not been in Myanmar. The country is littered with toll booths and checkpoints, which are collectively known as gates, and money changes hands every time a vehicle goes through them. And those small sums add up. It could be a very lucrative posting. So these soldiers, I wonder, do they genuinely believe that the military is going to win? Because if the military loses this fight and they do not defect, they will lose everything. They will very likely be arrested. They will definitely lose their position in the military. They will lose their money. Their shares in MEC, MEHL will be worth nothing. Do they truly believe the military will win?
I think like some of them might truly believe that military will win, but some of them, they even don't have to believe that military will win. They can gather as much profit as they can, and they can run away with their, you know, money bags and everything when everything goes south for them. So yeah, I don't think they have to believe that military will win. They have to like exploit their power and their position. And then when you say about the small changes in across the toolkit, actually it is. It's small change is just for the civilian who has done nothing wrong. It's just a small extortion. But especially for the, you know, black markets and other things like wools and jewelry and everything, and there's a lot of trading parts. For them, the gate are not asking for a, you know, small transaction or small bribery. They are asking a very large amount of the bribery, like every day, like millions and millions of dollars, not dollars, sorry, millions and millions of checks have to be bribed to that local gate authority. So yeah, it's a large business.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. But so it's fascinating. And I think this is very important, because you're saying that even this category, the greedy people, they're motivated by their own interests. They're not motivated by the military. They're only motivated by their own interest. And that means that they are still preparing and are willing to leave the military. They also are willing to defect if they feel that that is in their best interest.
Yes, that's why some of the defector came to the resistance forces, because they think they can have their access and their saving monies and everything, and they can live in that particular region. So some of them might defect because of their own interest. So when our resistance forces and the M group became large enough to grant for these kind of people to keep their earning and profit, I think a lot of them can like defect to the safe place. So but we. Our forces don't have that kind of ability yet. They are still fighting for it.
Mm. And so I wonder, because I heard that defectors were being given money, especially if you defect with weapons and ammunition and things like this, that you would be paid by the revolution. And the society would take care of you. I mean, you yourself, you are a defector. How did society treat you after you defected?
Yes, and most of the society was a pro-democratic people. So yeah, everyone can, you know, like gladly accept and gladly offer help. But the thing is that the charges for helping a CDM member or defector, it is also a large punishment, at least 5 or 10 years in the prison. And also a lot of the civilians are also struggling with their daily life and their daily business. So yes, there is support going on for the, you know, CDM civilian civil servants and CDM defector, but I think it is nobody's fault that no one can give enough support to these members. So everyone has to struggle to keep living, to keep earning for the family, for our own life. So now that all the CDM members and defector has to struggle in their own ways. But at least we can sleep at night saying that we are not doing atrocity for those kind of organization. So that's the real situation. People might waken us, but they have very limited ability and like financial and other resources to help us. So yes, so most of the soldiers and most of the civil servants like CDM and defector have to think about, after defecting, how would they continue to survive? That you would call it that the enforcer reward a large amount of money to the defector who bring ammunition and gun to them, because you know it's like the same war that they have to buy guns from other place. So when a defector came to them, like they are not only getting the ammunition, they have one less people to kill or to be killed. So yes, that's a win-win situation. But then again, every defector had to think about the long term. How would they walk? What can they walk in the civilian society? What could be their profession and things like that? Yeah, they had to consider those kind of things.
Mm. So, nevertheless, we are in a situation where we have a very, very large part of the military who do not defect because they are afraid of the punishment, and those who do not defect because they do not see profit. So the suggestion is that we could have very, very, very high numbers of defections if we could find a way to motivate these groups. Do you think there is a solution? Do you think there is something that the NUG or the PDF or the EAOs or any group could be doing to help increase the number of defections?
Yes, I think sometimes they are like they are, for example, for NUG government, sometimes they are clean. They have like very limited resource to promise the safety and the you know well-being of the defector. Like they, so if I have the, for example, large amount of access or the resources, I can just declare that I will give you a safe place and I will feed you. And everything is over. And then, you know, if I can grant it like that, and then I can even grant it then, like, I will give you your old position if you still want to serve in the reform military or reform federal government. And then I can even say that even when the military has failed and then all their access were seized, maybe we can protect the access of the defected soldier. If the government, as a government like NUG or at the M Group, can guarantee those kind of things, but it is, I don't think it's possible right at the moment. They have like very limited resources. But if they can promise those kind of things, like I think there might be like double, they can just double and triple the defector, because you know everyone wants to look after themselves. So yeah. Mm. I think that's the one of the solution, but it is very hard to achieve in the right now, since we need a lot of resources just to like keep protect our civilian and the pre-existing defector, and then they have to find funding to like fight and defend the territory and things like that. So yeah, the resources are the problem, I think.
That makes sense. It just sort of reminds me of, there's an old saying, and I can't find the actual the original wording of it, but it basically says, what if they announce a war and nobody shows up? This idea that, well, you can't fight a war if everyone decides to stay home and not join. And it's so difficult for me to understand what is happening right now, because what you seem to be saying to me is that the Myanmar military as it exists was never 500,000 people, was never 400,000 people. It's a small number military. And even within that, the majority of the people are not capable of fighting. They are not fit for military service. And even within that, only about 25% of those people actually believe in what the military is doing and believe that what they are doing is right. If we put all of these together, it seems like the Myanmar military, the actual military, the people who are willing to fight and who are capable of fighting, are tiny, tiny, maybe 50,000 at most. And everybody else could just turn around because they want to leave, because they don't believe the military will win, because they don't believe that the military is right, because they know that they are sick, they know that they are old, they know that they are injured, they know that they can't fight. If they all turned around and left, the war would end tomorrow. And they must all be aware of this. And yet they continue to act in their jobs. They continue to do their jobs. They continue to fight or pretend to fight. And they prolong this war. And this is difficult for me to understand. Why are they not realizing that once a large enough number of people leave, the cascade will begin and everybody else will start leaving? Because the military is no longer able to sustain itself, it will collapse. What will it take to trigger this moment when everyone just decides, I've had enough, I'm going home?
Yes, we can just look at the history, and there are such kind of oppression and dictatorship all over the country, in many countries. But there has never been such kind of thing like the people's, or the whole country is fighting against the dictator, or like half of the people from the dictator troops were leaving to fight against the people. Because we know in theory, yes, that kind of unity can like end the war instantly. And that is what I was hoping when I leave the military. So if there enough people like me leave the military, we can stop the bloodbath. We can stop the ongoing like prolonged wars. But it didn't happen. You know, it is like the things. There's some old story, like maybe you might have of it, like a king demands his citizens to bring a milk to be poured into a large pot, but no one will see that whether you pour the milk or water. And then again, after every citizen have poured the milk into the pot, and the next day the pot was filled with just water, because everybody think that no one would pour the real milk if no one is seeing what they are pouring into the pot. So that's this water milk situation in the country. So everyone might think if they leave the military, but if the other are not leaving the military, and if the military wins, so people like us might get really, really big punishment, strikes, and penalties and everything. So everyone have a very hard time to believe that the majority of the people and the majority of the military personnel will leave to end the war. So I think that kind of thing is happening in any other country with the digital shape of war. So not everyone is like have the courage to do the right thing, and that could lead to such kind of prolonged wars and strikes and sufferings.
Okay, so this is a very important question. You've told me a lot of really important things here, but do the other people in the military know the things that you are telling me? Are they aware of these problems and these situations?
Oh, I think it's only, it might be like half of the population might know these kind of thing, because since most of the soldiers, they don't have any proper education. And then since before the coup, they were forbidden to follow and like the real media outlets, that is like revealing the truth about the country. So they are forced to follow and like the military pro-regime channels, and military-owned TV channels. And they some of the battalions and some of the forces are being forced to watch the military-owned channel news every night. And then the commander, they are like weekly or monthly keep saying the wrong situation, that they are winning, that they are in the right position, and they are doing the right thing, and these kind of things. Like that kind of propaganda has been going on the military for decades. And for those people who don't have enough interaction with the civilian, and who don't have the chance to get a grip of reality, like they might stay be in their propaganda, and they might still be brainwashed that they are doing the right thing, these kind of things like that. Even, the greedy people, and even the military, even the second group, that the people that know the military is wrong, they might not get in there, enough information about the real situation that going on all over the country, they might be like enclosed in the military, and they might be hearing about that. Although they know the military is wrong, they might be knowing that now the military is winning, or like all the rebellious forces, resistance forces are losing, and they could be fed those kind of false information from their commander and from their sister.
Interesting. And so, because this is then leading on to the question of the leadership, because I have often wondered about this. The base commanders, when we're talking about people who are at the major level and the colonel level, are they committed to the cause? Because it feels to me that if you have a military base and you have maybe 120 soldiers, of whom, if you are lucky, half are actually capable of fighting. And in addition to this, you have maybe 250, 300 civilians, the parents, the children, the wives of the soldiers living on the base with you. It feels to me that if you are a major, if you are a colonel in this position, ethically, you would have to suggest to your soldiers, if you are surrounded by the enemy, we should just surrender to protect ourselves, to protect our families. That is the best thing that we can do. And yet it doesn't seem very common for people who are commanders of bases to be sympathetic to defection. And everyone seems to be afraid of the base commanders finding out that they want to defect and punishing them. So what is generally the case? Are people who are in these officer positions, are they aware of the true reality, or are they also brainwashed? Are they more likely to be completely loyal to the military, or are they less likely to be completely loyal to the military?
Yes. So if I have to answer the question, I have to say about the group of people and the percentage of what kind of people are usually included in those groups. For example, the coward group, for example, that people know exactly that they are in the wrong organization, but they are afraid to leave. Those kind of people usually used to be a very educated people, like engineers and doctors and other graduated people. And then the greedy group, are supposed to be those kind of leaders, like majors and colonels and those kind of things, because they are so close. They have like enough power to earn a lot of money by controlling gays, and they are very close to begin a brigadier or general that could make the whole family like very wealthy in that kind of situation. So most of the commanders, like majors and like battalion commander, colonels, who can really make a change in the battle, like most of them are very greedy, and sometimes they want to cling their position and their profits until the end, because opposite to that is that they will lose all their access and they will be punished severely for surrendering the enemy, and they will, in other case, they will have nothing, and they can at least still live. But sometimes people can still choose their profits and their position over their lives. Sometimes people can be that greedy sometimes. So the thing is that most of the middle range commanders were included in those greedy people. That's the problem, that very few people can surrender when it comes to time. That so I think that could answer your questions.
Absolutely. And so let's move up the chain of command. Let's go to the generals. And I think it may be very difficult for you to know. It's difficult for any of us to know, but I think this is perhaps the most critical. When we look at Minar Laing, he knows that he's fighting for his life and his future. When we look at Saw Win, we know that he's a psychopath and he's dedicated to this. Saw Win is the second in command. But when we look at the other generals, the other high-level leaders, they have lost a lot because of the coup. Some of them are on sanctions lists. Their families are on sanctions lists. They are losing their ability to travel internationally. They are losing their ability to make money internationally. Their assets have been frozen in some cases. MEC and MEHL is not returning money to them based on the shares that they own. And it has not been for some time. They are losing power. They are losing political power. They are losing money. Do they truly believe that the military should win? And do they truly believe that the military can win? Or is there a chance that the military will have a coup of its own and get rid of Minh Aung Hlaing?
Yeah, that's the thing with the generals, because, you know, when you get to that kind of level in the military, all of your profits, all of your interests are already aligned with other generals and top leaders, because you are already began, top share, major shareholder in that kind of organization. And then all of your company have already related with, every general has at least one or two companies already they have owned and doing business with their tycoons and cronies and other generals. So in the top group, all of their interests and profits were tied to each other. So when the coup started, some people, some civilians and some activists, like, they are hoping that there will be some internet coup that those kind of generals can, like, take down Minh Aung Hlaing and put the military in the right place. But as our military individual, we don't think it could be possible. It is very unlikely, because since they are, all the profits and business are tied together, it's one fall, they will bring down everyone in the top group. So that's the reason I think the top group is staying tight, and they just hold on each other together and hoping to win and, like, to share the profit together in the future. It might not be right, because I'm not a generalist, but according to my experience and opinion, I think that's what happened in the top part of military. That is why no one went to fight against the Minh Aung Hlaing.
A topic that fascinates me deeply, and it's not, I think, particularly significant to the strategic position of the military, but I think it is still very important to understand about the military, is the what I refer to personally as the cult of the military. It feels very much to me that within the Thammadaw, there is a very unusual version of Buddhism, something that is very old, very traditional style, and that teaches the members of the military to be sexist and to feel entitled. So one example that we saw of this back in 2021 was when the women would hang their clothes across the street and soldiers would not walk underneath these women's clothes. This is a very, very old Myanmar tradition. How seriously do soldiers take this?
Yes, I must say it's not even a real Buddhism. It's like just a very superstitious and very, misconcept and very conservative belief. But it grows very strong and is rooted in the military for a very long time. Since, when our people leader, Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi, was detained in her house arrest just way before the 2010s and something, around 90s, that the top commander like Dan Shui and Ken Yeung, like they had every general and also themselves wear a woman garment called longji, that is like a skirt to a Myanmar traditional woman. So they wear it so that, and like it's like a, some kind of ritual or something. So when you say about different Buddhism, actually the top commander and soldier really believe in their, chants and amulets, rituals that were, guided by some kind of fortune tellers, some kind of, shamans in some country. So they really believe in that stuff. So even I had a rumor, but it was a very firm rumor, that when the young people and civilians start protesting in the country, they were shot exactly to the heart instead of other place, because some of the troops were commanded that they had to shoot the civilian to the heart, because it is a ritual that were instructed to the military leader by a corrupted monk. I mean, yeah, it's you know, it's like, you know, dark matches or things like that. He suggested that if you want to win and if you want to change the country, you have to shoot the opposite in the heart. So they have that kind of very serious ritual belief in their system. And they really follow those kind of ritual. Even the our country base, like Manis, they have like those kind of elephants and lions, and everything was connected to the past rituals and the past fortune teller told the you know, military leaders before me online. That kind of ridiculous thing is always happening in the military for many decades. And when Myanmar people, like even the civilian, like they used to believe there is something called poem in Myanmar language. It's like an aura that keep a person like successful and lucky and everything like that. They think that form can be reduced if they want enter a, you know, woman garments and if they want into a sanitary place. So for Isame, even when the, you know, military leaders like generals and Ming Online came to inspect the hospital, they never go inside a woman works, like for example gynecology or obstetric works. They never go there because they believe that those kind of areas can lower their poem. So they have like a lot of, like I cannot count how many, they have a lot of those ridiculous superstition like rituals going on inside them. And they are also using it like a weapon. Because, you know, in some part of our country, like all civilians, they believe that a country leader has to be like highest poem and the highest aura to be deserved to rule the country. Even when they see a democratically elected president or like state councillor, they are still seeing him or her as king or queen. Like some people are that conservative in our country. So that's why the Myanmar line is trying to find, like desperately trying to find the white elephant, since it is the, you know, symbols of our old Myanmar kings. So every time a white elephant came to a, you know, state leaders, it means that the leader is deserved to lead the country or to be worthy as a king. So now he's like trying to find those genetically like defeated albino elephants. It's like a livestock for us, like academic person, but it really works for some people inside the country. As long as he keep like building big pagodas and big monastery, and he keep finding those kind of white elephants, some people might think that he is the right leader for the country. This is ridiculous, but it still work in some part, some population of the country.
And so this is the thing about this, because the degree to which the military takes this seriously is confusing and shocking. I remember that, for example, there was we would say in English a fortune teller, bedinseya, but bedinseya is more than fortune teller. And he cast a curse on Facebook, he cast a curse on Minar Lang's family. And he was arrested for this. And then Minar Line was seen wearing a protective amulet. It seems that the military truly believe in these superstitions. They believe in black magic. They believe in their power. Obviously, we all remember Ne Win when he changed the money to 35 and 45 and 90 and all this stuff. Very ritualistic. And this is very confusing to me, because this is something that you don't really see outside the military. Like, I assume in the military they would tell the story of Anoyata, who the women threw their tamain on his statue and he was killed by a gnat because he lost his pawn. But then we saw young men after the coup wearing tamain, women's clothes, on their head to protest this superstition. So many in Myanmar society reject this, and they say this is backwards, this is sexist, but in the military it's almost like a religion. Why does this stay alive in the military?
Because, you know, that is because of the our history of education and government, we have been under the military dictatorship for more than 60 years. And all those 60 years, all the military leaders are that kind of stupid and superstitious, and they believe in rituals. So they let the education and they let those traditions live alive inside the people so that they can manipulate the people to continue holding their power. It's like Nei Wing and Dan Shui. And so when it came to me, I'm like, why were not he using that kind of ritualistic powers? And he can also manipulate the people, and also he will believe as his ancestor has already successfully ruled the country with those kind of superstitions. So, I mean, it's really depend on the education and how the people were enlightened. Because in the past, if someone has to talk against the ritual and against this belief, they can just arrest him and put him into the prison, like for insulting the people's tradition and people's religion. So yes, it's people's brains and their insights and their way of thinking were already suppressed and oppressed about like 60 years by the generation of military dictators. So it's not a wonder that those kind of superstitions stay rooted inside the country up until now, because we got a very bad education and very bad leaders.
And what I've always wondered is, does this system, because it feels, as I said, I call this the cult of the military. It feels like the military has created its own special type of religion that the soldiers follow. And it is this another way that the military controls its soldiers and makes them see Min Hao Lang not as an officer who has been appointed to a job, but as more of a almost spiritual figure? Is there a religious element to the leadership of the military?
Yes, actually, the Min Hao Lang didn't even have to create those kind of special religions, because since his seniors like Nei Wing and Dan Shui has created enough superstition and misconception among the country and among their forces, so he can just continue using those kind of things. And then he could just approach to some monks, like corrected monks. We can just see some of the talks where well-respected monks were siding with Min Hao Lang, for example, like Tita Goose or things like that. They are one of the biggest religious leaders in the country, and he can just approach to them and he can just make them say what he wants them to say to the people. Like, they can just shift the words and the teaching of the Buddha into like twist their own fashion. In Buddhism, like, it's clearly said that we have to love everyone, and we cannot kill anyone. That's the primary rule of the Buddhism. But the monk and the Min Hao Lang can just twist that kind of words like an extreme, and like, if you kill the people that are worshiping other religion, you might not be guilty from the hell and from the way of Buddha. So that they could just twist the words of the Buddhism by the help of some top religious leader. I think you were saying that kind of special religion, right?
Yes. And so the other element of this, the other side of the coin then, is this religious indoctrination or pseudo-religious indoctrination and superstition, is this used by the military to help convince their soldiers that it is acceptable and moral for them to hurt the civilians? Because it feels to me like the military soldiers are almost offended when civilians say, no, we do not accept your authority. We do not accept that you should lead the country. We want our democracy back. They feel like they're angry children who have been told that they cannot have something that they really want. Is this religion convincing them that they are entitled to lead and are entitled to rule over the civilians?
Yes, this is already, they are already convinced that if they serve for a leader that is trying to protect the Buddhism, trying to protect the religions, and trying to protect the old pressure tradition. So if they are doing his work, like they might be doing it for the religion and for the gentry, and they might easily believe that they are doing the right thing about those brutality and atrocity. That's the easiest way to manipulate them. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is incredible. I don't know what to do with all of this information. I think it is a privilege to have this insight. It's a privilege to know this. And what I very much hope is that we as a podcast can get feedback from our listeners on things that they would like to know and to understand better about the military, and that hopefully we could have you return at some point and provide additional information and additional context about the military, because understanding your enemy, understanding how they think and what motivates them, and understanding how we can reach out to the soldiers who want to defect, I think is critical to winning this war. And I think that the information you're providing and the insights that you're providing are just absolutely vital and are invaluable. So I want to leave our interview here for today. But before we end the interview, we always have the tradition that you're probably aware of, because I know you listen to our podcast. We always invite our guests to leave the audience with something to think about, some comments, some message that you would like to give directly to the people listening. So if there's anything that you would like to say to our listeners, please take this opportunity and share your thoughts.
Yes, as I would like to say before, yes, I mean, injustice is very infectious. I mean, when I country was go into the coup and the civil war, I have very much hope that like United Nations and most of the country could be like prevent it and things like that. And I was worried that if they couldn't like stop this coup, and then it could lead to chain reaction, because like other countries that are potentially trying to make a coup, or like trying to bring back the dictatorships or things like that, those countries might be watching us whether we can succeed or not in this very 21st century. And now they are seeing that if they see that like some country in the African and some country in the Asia, if they see like this could work, like the UN cannot do anything over this kind of coup, and then there will be like consequences. That's what I'm always saying. I was even worried about like invading to the Ukraine or Taiwan after this kind of thing happened, because China and Russia already know that UN could not do anything to stop them, those kind of things. So that's what I was worried. And I think in now some people from the China or Russia might think like they are in the power or things like that. But as I say before, injustice can be very infectious. And if more countries would believe in the power instead of, you know, dialogues and instead of justice, if more country believed it, it would backfire to every nation in the world. And China and Russia will not be also an exception, you know. So every dictator has already corrupted mind, and everyone has want more and more. And I think this sometimes like letting slip some kind of small injustice could lead to a chain reaction, like I don't know, hydrogen bombs or things like that. It could destroy the world. That's what I believe. Yeah, I just want to drop this kind of opinion for your listener, that I think some of them might agree with me.
Thank you for listening to this episode in full. You know, by this point, we've aired a few hundred episodes, with many more scheduled, and every single one of them is available at no charge. We are committed to keeping our platform freely accessible into the foreseeable future so that anyone, anywhere, can learn about the situation in Myanmar. At a time when keeping global awareness on the country is so critical, it's more important than ever to share these stories widely. So to ensure that we can continue offering these programs without any barriers or paywalls in the way, we've launched a membership program. Becoming a member not only helps us in this drive to sustain our platform and bring you more vital interviews, it also comes with benefits like advanced releases, behind the scenes content, exclusive discounts at our shop, and more. So if you'd like to support us and gain access to these perks, visit insightmyanmar.org/membership to learn more. Thank you for being a part of this mission. Of course, we also welcome contributions of any kind as well, and invite you to visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to learn more about the ways that you can contribute.
Oh, ba, yara nanda da yara nanga na yara nanga da yara nanga po da ba yara nanga.